The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to the Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and it is good to be back with you tonight. One of the most revered institutions in all of America is the National Geographic Society. Their iconic magazine, with a yellow border, has graced many a bookshelf, certainly in my home, and I would suspect many of yours. And at 129 years of age, National Geographic continues to reinvent itself for a new generation and a new world. That ongoing transformation is being led by my first guest tonight, Gary Nell, the president and CEO of the National Geographic Society. And we will continue with our Better Than Most Corporate Culture series, as well as a Take 5 lightning round and other things to fill out the hour. But first, the Business Giving News Digest for Sunday, October 1st. The Internet Association, a trade association of global internet companies, has announced a commitment of $300 million over 5 years in support of K-12 computer science education. A new report gives the country an F grade on attempts to make it easier and safer for all citizens to get places without a car. Social change platform DoSomething.org has announced that it has received $8.6 million in funding in support of efforts to mobilize young people to take civic action. This will enable DoSomething to foster a community of leaders and lifelong advocates for critical issues such as criminal justice reform, climate change, and civic engagement. The Millennial Impact Report finds that only 29% of millennials believe the country is going in the right direction, while 39% said they believe it's going in the wrong direction, and 32% were unsure. And finally, last week was United Nations General Assembly Week here in New York, and for many a year, the Clinton Global Initiative was a fixture during this time in which the world's most pressing social problems were all addressed. They, of course, suspended operations last year, and there now appears to be a successor to it. It is the Bloomberg Global Business Forum, which last week featured Bill Clinton himself, Bill Gates, and LeBron James, among others. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. We'll be back with Gary Nell of the National Geographic Society right after this.
Top companies have now begun to discover a reliable source for skilled new talent, and they're finding great success with employees who are productive, engaged, and innovative. Explore the country's largest untapped talent pool, 24 million Americans with disabilities. The National Organization on Disability is the leading partner for companies looking to accelerate their disability employment efforts, attract, hire, and retain. Learn more at NOD.org.
Do you remember your first job? We all deserve opportunity, but the frustrating truth is that while talent is equally distributed in the U.S., opportunity is not. 6 million talented young adults in the U.S. are out of work and out of school. Year Up empowers these young adults with valuable skills and connects them to leading U.S. companies. The results are real. 85% of Year Up alums are employed or in school within 4 months of graduating. Support opportunity for all young adults. Visit yearup.org.
Well, my husband is a retired sergeant from the Air Force.
Well, he was in the Army for 14 years and an MP.
23 million veterans, they're heroes who need our help.
Well, I'm here because my daughter has had her third surgery for cancer.
We've had some difficulties, so we're here quite some time. We're going on to 3 weeks.
When our heroes' families need help, they turn to Fisher House.
We learned about the Fisher House through the doctor, and we were so grateful because who has 3 weeks to be able to come and stay at a hotel?
Fisher House is a safe, free place to stay for families of wounded warriors and veterans receiving treatment at VA and military medical centers.
Fisher House is not only a home away from home, it was like family away from family.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Helping military and veterans families. Fisher House at fisherhouse.org. Sometimes having family close by is a hero's best medicine.
If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from the Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember?
remember how to swim.
Legacy institutions, many of them over 100 years old, have an immunity to change because so many of our organizations are architected to resist change and withstand risk. So when you see one that is successfully reinventing itself for the 21st century, taking its brand from reverence to relevance, you really take notice. One such organization is the National Geographic Society, and it is a pleasure to have with us this evening their president and CEO, Gary Nell. Good evening, Gary, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Denver, it's really great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
But let us start with some of that legacy, if you will, and share with our listeners a little bit about the history of the National Geographic Society and the mission of the organization.
Yeah, so 129 years ago, 27 guys, and they were guys, got together at the Cosmos Club in Washington, D.C. This was an era of discovery and exploration. The Smithsonian Institution had been started just a few years before with the legacy of diffusing knowledge. And the folks around National Geographic felt we need to diffuse geographic knowledge. So it was an amazing group of pioneers. Some of them could have been, you know, working in hipster coffee shops, I like to say. But they were out there as geographers, scientists, explorers, wanting to tell the public about the beauties of the West and exploration and satisfy the curiosity gene that so many people have. I would just say also the first issue, Denver, was the cover story was the geologic strata of the Potomac River, a real page turner. If there ever was one. So over time, when Alexander Graham Bell took over as the second president and his son-in-law, Bert Grosvenor, they introduced photography into National Geographic, really the first major publication to introduce photography. Two board members quit in protest because they thought it would dumb down the magazine.
No kidding.
They were wrong. So don't always listen to your board of directors. I'm sure my chairman will be thrilled with that comment. So, but, you know, the rest is history, where National Geographic, of course, is known primarily for photography and storytelling and visual storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a courageous move back then that has paid off in so many ways.
1888. National Geographic covers the planet and beyond, unlike anybody else. Science, exploration, culture, environment, ecosystems, animals, and so on. So let me ask you a big picture question, if I can. What's your assessment of the planet in 2017? Is anything getting better? And what are you really worried about?
Well, there are things getting better, and there's a lot of amazing people, you know, in the sector of public service and NGOs and governments and the private sector that are doing incredible things. And the biggest issue, really, though, is we've got so many people on our planet. We're going to have 9.5 billion people here by 2050. There's twice as many people on the planet today than there were since we graduated high school. We're probably roughly the same age. And that wasn't that long ago. So it wasn't 1888. But and how can the planet really sustain all these people? How can we feed them, educate them, provide energy for them, house them without burning up everything in or on the planet? That's the big question. And when I posed this actually in Washington, where we're based, to Republicans and Democrats, nobody says, boy, that's a dumb question. This is a nonpartisan existential question that we need to face head on. And we hope that National Geographic can provide some answers and pose some of those questions to give our political leaders and others a longer lens that they can look through as opposed to the quarterly lens that so many of our organizations are stuck with.
Yeah, well, you are certainly leading a lot of these conversations. It was just about 2 years ago that the National Geographic Society expanded its relationship with 21st Century Fox and a venture called National Geographic Partners. How does that partnership work, and what have been some of the benefits of it to the National Geographic Society?
Well, it's been a terrific partnership. The leaders of 21st Century Fox, led by their CEO, James Murdoch, have been fantastic partners who really believe in our mission, are certainly putting a lot of resources behind it. They're out there publicly, really promoting Nat Geo as one of their core assets, creative assets.
Mm-hmm.
We had almost 20-year partnership, Denver, with 21st Century Fox on the National Geographic Channel that Fox owned 70% of. And it is now the largest cable channel in the world in terms of distribution. It reaches about 450 million people around the world.
Wow.
In 170 countries. And in many countries, National Geographic is known through the channel even more than the print magazine. So what we did 2 years ago is we simply put our print assets, books and magazines, and our digital assets into the cable venture. So we now have a 70-30 partnership. Mm-hmm. There's a joint board between Fox and National Geographic Society people that oversee that. We have a lot of bells and whistles about making sure that it's still consistent with the mission of National Geographic and the brand of National mm-hmm. Geographic, so it doesn't go off sideways in some place. And I would say that so far it's been a resounding success. The other part, which is critically important, is because we were able to monetize some of the equity around the print magazine and the digital, we've been able to create a $1.2 billion endowment now to fund scientific exploration and storytelling pioneers out in the world, which is something now with this war chest, we can double down on our impact.
That's wonderful. And it was about a year ago that you underwent this extensive rebranding effort across all your media platforms, reinforcing this idea of one National Geographic. As a matter of fact, I think in some ways you almost dropped the word channel, you know, because you just wanted to
we
get that concept.
We did drop the word channel, and it's now National Geographic on air.
Yeah. So give us your thinking around this rebrand and what the impact of it has been so far.
Well, I'm a big believer in brands, and as I have had the privilege to oversee big brands like Sesame Street and NPR and National Geographic, we have to stick to our knitting, and I think consumers and know actually much more than you think they do, knowing when things are off brand, mm-hmm. and you can lose people and dilute yourself very easily chasing a buck. So it's critically important that we stick to our knitting, that Sesame Street really was and still is all about educating preschoolers to give them an opportunity to succeed. And NPR is really about educating the public about national and global affairs and inspiring them. And National Geographic is really about satisfying the curiosity that will get people inspired to care for the planet. So we have to come back to those all the time. And we actually have these conversations at National Geographic every week.
Yeah.
Is this on brand? Is this not on brand? How do we make sure it is on brand? It's a really important part of what we try to do.
And with this new rebranding, you also have a tagline, right?
We do. I mean, we further has really been what we've tried to express in one word, which cuts across all of our media. And it's really a human inspiration to go further, which has been, of course, the legacy of Alexander Graham Bell, mm-hmm. who not only invented the telephone, but also came within a week of putting the first airplane into flight, which most people don't even know. He was a serial inventor. But then we funded people like Hiram Bingham and Jacques Cousteau and Jane Goodall and Diane Fossey and the Leakeys and all kinds of other people, all the way to today, where we have amazing pioneers with that exploration gene. And they all had the inspiration to go further, hence the idea that each of us have that opportunity in our own lives.
Very cool. Well, you alluded to it before, but you do have a huge audience, not the least of which is that you are the number one brand on Instagram, which is not bad for a 129-year-old organization. How many people do you reach across the globe?
Well,
monthly?
Of course, it all depends on how you count these things, but over 750 million people around the world, 78 million Instagram followers. We're not quite where Kim Kardashian is, but we're working very hard to overtake her. So we hope that the listeners of this show will go on Instagram if they're not members already. But it's really about photography, and I have to give credit to my predecessors who were nimble and entrepreneurial to be able to take what was simply a print magazine and push it into books, push it into television, push it into cable, push it into social media. And now through integration and scale, we have an opportunity to make a much bigger impact. As, of course, Denver, we live in a world that's cluttered with information every day. And the big existential question for organizations like ours is how do you break through the clutter? And how does National Geographic land on, you know, in Denver's headspace every day, as opposed to all the other inputs that are coming in into you? When you break it down to an individual's media diet, that's really what at the end of the day, this is all about. So we've got to have compelling, engaging content that's also consistent with our brand.
Absolutely. You know, I'd be curious, under this rebrand of Further and this integration of all your platforms under one National Geographic, has that improved your ability to collect and use data more effectively to address the needs of your consumers as well as your corporate partners?
This is a really good question. The National Geographic Society almost invented the concept of membership. And actually, if you go back to 1939, It's a Wonderful Life. Go back and watch the movie. Jimmy Stewart opens up, gets an envelope in the mail and says, I've officially been elected a member of the National Geographic Society.
He was quite excited.
Right. Exactly. And it really became a rite of passage. It was, as we had a tagline in the 1950s, it said, tell people you read National Geographic. It defines you. And I love that.
That's great.
And I'm sure Don Draper or someone like him invented that back in the 1950s. But it was this concept of membership. So we've tried to make people do more than simply subscribe. We have millions of people, at least 10 million people, who are part of the database of National Geographic. And it's really a challenge now to figure out how you reinvent this concept of membership in the 21st century. So people are part of a tribe, which I'm a big believer in, like Seth Godin talks about.
Right.
And how do we then make them feel part of the tribe and interact with us through content, but also through action in terms of helping make the world a better place? And that's our big challenge right now. So we're working very hard on this concept of membership across the society and across partners to have an integrated offering that will inspire a lot of people to stay with National Geographic. This is probably the biggest issue we have going forward.
Mm-hmm. You know, of all the things that sets National Geographic apart, Gary, perhaps the thing that stands out most to me is your global leadership in storytelling. What is the key? What is the secret to really great storytelling?
It's really about capturing people's emotions. And we have had the ability through the incredible storytellers we have through photography, through journalism, through film, to be able to get people to understand these complex issues that are impacting their lives. So, Denver, we've divided the work of geography into three pieces, the changing planet, wildlife and wild places, and the human journey. And there are so many stories baked into that, and getting people to understand and open their eyes to the fact that there were 500,000 lions in the wild when we were born, and today there's 20,000. That there's an elephant being killed every 15 minutes today in the wild. Rhinos being decimated, sharks and rays, just on the wildlife issues.
Yeah.
So how can we bring those issues to light to get people to care? And I think that's what great filmmakers do. I mean, you know, I grew up in L.A. And I tell people that, you know, the world was open to me through movies, and it was storytelling that inspired me to get out of, you know, get out of my own childhood into seeing that there was this incredible world out there of heroes and other cultures that were so fascinating. And I think I've taken that to heart since being a student into my career as the heart of what we do, because at the end of the day, storytelling is about education.
Mm-hmm.
And as Joan Ganz Cooney, the founder of Sesame Street, always would say, is television was the most powerful teacher ever invented. It's not a question of whether it was teaching, his question is, what was it teaching?
Yeah.
So you can either teach kids letters and numbers, or you can teach them about sugar cereal, but you're teaching them. So, and we all know that television shows, movies, a photograph, an article, this radio show can inspire people if people are really involved and engage with the content. So it's a more powerful vehicle than any politician.
Right. You know, as part of that storytelling, you introduced your first scripted series earlier this year with a show called Genius. What was that show about, and what else do you have in the store for other scripted series?
Well, we were thrilled to do that. We always felt that National Geographic could use its brand to expand into a storytelling about inspiring individuals. So who's the at the top of that list from a scientific point of view, Albert Einstein.
So no doubt.
We acquired the rights to Walter Isaacson's brilliant book, biography, and thanks to Ron Howard and Brian Grazer at Imagine Entertainment, we created a 10-part series starring Jeffrey Rush that was nominated for 11 Emmys, and which is an amazing feat for us and wonderful to be there recently at the Emmys. So that is what we presented was really the story of Einstein's humanity, his life story, not just what we think of him as this kind of old man with his, you know, with wild hair. He had an incredible life story, leaving Nazi Germany and really being quite a leader in political thought and other things. Next year, we're going to be doing Pablo Picasso. We're really excited about that story as well, who someone who, of course, the brilliant artist that he was, but his involvement with the Spanish Civil War and using the power of the paintbrush to express history. And Antonio Banderas is going to play Pablo Picasso, so stay tuned for that one.
Absolutely. It's nice to make these people really come alive and who they were and not just what they did. You know, it seems that the offerings on the National Geographic Network are brighter, they're bolder, seem to me to be more premium content, high-end, than they had been in the past. Would that be the case?
Yes, and there's multiple reasons for that. I would suggest a couple things. One, it's the right thing to do because that's what our brand is about. That's first and foremost. And if you live up to the legacy of the people who I mentioned before and the magazine, we want the channel to live up to that same legacy. In many ways, and I'll just say this, it was chasing sort of cable television ratings. And recently I was having this discussion, and we all remember when cable started, there were a lot of niche channels around. Discovery was very much about science. Mm-hmm. You had history about history. You had arts and entertainment, actually about arts and entertainment. You had the Learning Channel actually trying to do learning. And now those channels, of course, have almost nothing to do with those areas, almost nothing. So they become general channels that in many ways, if I may say, are chasing reality TV type dumbed down programming. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, Nat Geo was doing that as well. When I took over the organization, our board of trustees rightfully was somewhat concerned about this. And I think this new strategy not only is the right thing to do living up to the brand, but also from an economic point of view today with Netflix and Amazon and everybody else really honing this concept of on-demand viewing as opposed to watching linear channels where you just have to fill up a bulk of 24/7 programming with stuff. We have to be there. Yeah. We have to actually come up with content that people are going to be willing to, quote unquote, buy. Mm-hmm. In other words, they're going to be willing to set down some time to watch Genius or to watch this incredible series, The Long Road Home, another drama out of Martha Raddatz's brilliant book about returning Iraq veterans.
Yeah.
So there's both qualitative reasons and economic reasons to push this into a new place, and that's what we've done. We have a lot of work to do. I would say National Geographic Channel in some ways got a little lost in the mix, mm-hmm. and now we've got to earn respect again and be there as a preferred home just the way HBO and Netflix and others have become.
Yeah, there's a lot of stations, so people have to be able to find you, and this is one way they're going to be able to find you. Gary, how do you look at and measure the impact of what you're doing, particularly around particular issues, whether it be climate change? I know you did this fantastic cover story on gender in the magazine in January. How do you look at the impact that those things are having?
Yeah, and that gender story won a Pulitzer nomination, the first one ever for National Geographic, and it was a very brave decision by our editor, Susan Goldberg, who's done a fantastic job. Well, this is always $600,000 question for nonprofits. How do you measure impact?
Yep.
Right? So, and I got asked, I've always been asked this question. So the question really is, there's a quantitative answer, mm-hmm. which has to do with ratings,
yep.
or people engaging with your stuff. So no matter what NGO you have, nonprofit you might be involved with, how many people are actually engaging is one measure. The other one is we have to test the impact. And I think I learned this a lot working at Sesame Workshop, which was very serious from the beginning about sending in third-party evaluators to literally, you know, ask the 5-year-old, you know, what did you learn from this? And the kid would, as kids are, would say, nothing, you know, or they would say, I learned how to count to 10 or whatever. Yeah. So there was a clear set of evaluations. And I think we will need to do that more, I think, in National Geographic. We know that sheer numbers we can gauge pretty well.
Yeah.
And these social media numbers, as you mentioned, are crazy high. And part of it is because of photography and being able to drive that. But we've also got a lot of programs working in wildlife, working in marine protected areas like pristine seas, working in the human journey, where we're giving grants to innovators around the world, and we want to make sure that they are impacting policy and are actually making a difference in saving lions or saving marine protected areas or what have you.
Let's talk about your corporate partners. You have some fabulous corporate partners, GSK, Rolex, a number of others. Tell us some of the things you're doing with them.
Yeah, so I think one of the shifts that we've been trying to make is because we're a bit of a non-traditional nonprofit because we have not really been reliant on public funding ever,
yeah.
Nor have we had a huge philanthropic history of, you know, individual giving the way a college or a hospital or others or a more traditional NGO might. So my view is we need to team up with foundations, with major donors, and with corporations who share a set of common interests. And some may be around the oceans.
Mm-hmm.
Some may be around just innovative people. Some may be around science or sustainable cities. So we have now connected up with folks like Rolex, and we recently signed a huge 5-year deal that will fund ocean exploration and telling those stories with Rolex, which we're very proud of. Canon's been a sponsor of ours for 54 years. I'm sorry, 64
mm-hmm.
years. And they're in every single issue of the magazine.
That covers a lot. I remember seeing that.
Yeah. and folks like GSK who sponsored Genius,
mm-hmm.
and United Technologies, who we did a big sustainable cities conference with. And these are companies who actually want to partner with the platform of National Geographic as a convener to have serious thought about this. And obviously, they want to position themselves as a leader and an influencer or folks working in rethinking cities and building and subways and all kinds of other things. They have obviously an interest in doing that, but more power to them to take the and elevate the conversation towards issues which we do need to talk about and we don't talk about enough.
Yeah. And as you said a few moments ago, they want to reach your tribe.
Exactly.
You know, you recently announced some plans around your grant making and how you plan on expanding it to reach more minorities and are launching some new funds to encourage more racial and ethnic diversity with this grant making. That's an important initiative. Tell us more about it.
Diversity is critically important, and for all the reasons which most of your listeners have heard before, not just the right thing to do, but from the economic point, you know, all these issues mm-hmm. are really important. But the thing, here's the problem. The scientific community and the environmental community have really, for not the wrong reasons, have grown as enterprises that have been too limited from a diversity point of view. And that has a lot to do with who went to college, who got a PhD, who had the opportunities to think about global systems and environment. And so those sectors are still too homogenous in
yeah.
terms of diversity. And I think everyone in the environmental movement, so to speak, knows that. So what we felt was having the opportunity by giving grants and expanding our canvas to people of color in science and environmental journalism, in photography, in exploration, in technology, in mapping, and in teaching, we could provide resources to people of color who really do want to engage, who haven't had that access before. So this is something we're really taking on now. We're very excited about, and we will have champions, I'm sure, emerging. If you look at the Neil deGrasse Tysons of the world,
yeah.
you know, there's amazing people who are there who can emerge. And the other thing I would say here is, you know, there in many ways, when you have had conversations people are prioritizing their own existence. They're prioritizing where do we spend money in urban neighborhoods, for instance. And environmental issues tend to get put at the back of the line.
Yeah.
So I've been engaging with different folks. And when you talk, and geography certainly is another one of those things. And that's just wrong because Flint, Michigan is a geography problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's teaching kids that water doesn't come from a spout in your bathroom. It actually comes from some aquifer or some lake or reservoir. So kids have no idea, nor do adults for that matter, where their water comes from.
You're right.
And Flint, Michigan would not have happened had people been more educated about that. So now it becomes a crisis and we have to put Band-Aids on it and everyone's screaming bloody murder and even the hurricane in Houston. A lot of geography lessons in there.
Yeah, no question. Okay? And I mean, I think you've even noticed that in some of your speeches when you're talking about water, you're just talking about water. But when you were speaking at Hampton College and you started talking about Flint, all of a sudden the audience becomes engaged because it's not theoretical, it's real.
Exactly.
You know, this past summer at the National Geographic Explorers Festival, you spoke about the major transition you've been through that has transformed the organization. Now, so many leaders find transforming an organization, changing its culture, to be incredibly difficult, and I suspect you probably did as well. But tell us about the transformation and some of the keys you found in successfully changing the corporate culture.
Culture always trumps strategy, as they
say. Yeah.
as has been said so many times. National Geographic has had an amazing culture of entrepreneurship, as I mentioned, and individual exploration. My view is that sort of also led to a bit of siloed behavior. Not because people wanted to be a silo. It's just because it's part of the DNA of the place of individualism. So in order to get us to the next place, I really felt like we had to break down those silos. And by the way, the staff all complained about it to me when I showed up.
Okay.
So it was
on your listening tour.
Yeah,
and
I did do a 100-day listening tour. And I heard a lot about our mission. I heard a lot about silos. I heard a lot about our digital strategy being kind of not very focused at the time. So we had to work hard to break down those silos.
How do you do it?
Well, a lot of it had to do with getting back to the mission, actually. And this is where I always try to get back to, whether it was at Sesame or at NPR or here. Is what are we actually trying to do here?
Mm-hmm.
And forget about the people for a second. Forget about the individuals. What are the core things? So we created a National Geographic. We inspire, we explore, and we storytell. Those
mm-hmm.
are the three things that we do, right? So we set up inspiration through science and exploration. We focus on storytelling through media and education, of course, in teaching kids. So it was a way of reformatting people's thinking to focus on the global work that we're doing in non-siloed ways. And all of a sudden, Susie has to talk to Bob because they may be on other sides of campus, but they're both working on educating kids. And they weren't talking to each other.
Yeah.
So, and you just have to reinforce that, Denver, through the tools that you have, including, frankly, compensation and performance reviews. People care when they're dinged on their paychecks for not behaving properly.
Yeah.
And it gets down to basics like that in changing a culture.
Wow. So you tie this mission and this culture all into the way you take a look at people and their performance reviews. So it really hits the bottom line there.
Yes.
Hey, we're in New York. So let me ask you about this. National Geographic Encounter recently opened up Ocean Odyssey up at Times Square. What is that experience like?
Well, we're very excited. That's a partnership that we have here in New York, and it's 44th Street, right off Schubert Alley. Check it out. The most stunning technology connecting with a story of connecting to the oceans, and we hope that kids and families and parents will experience this tour, this journey together, and come out of that experience after an hour or two somewhat changed. So people spend a lot of money to go to a Broadway show. this is the best Broadway show you can possibly – this is our planet. So you'll come out of this maybe not singing Hello, Dolly, but you'll be able to think a lot about the other critters and the importance of the ocean as our lungs and as our as the home of so much life on Earth.
Let me close with this, Gary. In addition to being a business leader, you're a number of other things, but right at the top of that list, I would put educator. Certainly in your previous posts, as you discussed, CEO of Sesame Street and NPR, and now with National Geographic, that's pretty much what you do. So taking a blend of those experiences, do you have a sense or a vision of what the future of education will look like and be?
I got interviewed for Time magazine recently about a story about Sesame Street, and which is going to have its 50th birthday in a couple of years. And they asked me, are you worried about the future of Sesame Street? I said, no, they'll be fine. I am worried about the future of education, and I am worried in this sense. It's this information overload that we all sense, and the rules of the game are completely changed, and we don't really know what we're doing So as a society. So we now have the big technology companies for good economic reasons trying to have big inputs into schools because they have – the best tools to navigate the world's knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And the question then is, how do we reinvent the knowledge base that is of the ages? So when we were growing up, it was reading a textbook about American history that was written by somebody and approved by the Texas State Board of Education or whoever it was.
Yeah.
And we were taught, and that textbook was slightly interpreted by our teachers probably. Today, it's a world of content, and you may have very different interpretations of American history.
Mm-hmm.
The whole controversy over statues is an example. I could see in one school being taught one way, in another school completely the opposite. So are we going to have a common history in this country? How are we going to teach right from wrong? How are we going to teach the history of slavery?
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to teach the environmental movement? I think all of these issues are up for grabs, and smart people have got to get their heads around this. I've been engaged, as you mentioned, in media and education for four decades, and that was the easy part. I think now it's going to be up to my successors, our successors, millennials who grew up as digital natives, unlike us as digital immigrants, to find the tools to be able to create some sort of national consensus around what we're teaching our kids. This is a massive challenge and gets way beyond the schools and the charter schools and the public schools and the private schools and all those debates, which are very important. At the end of the day, it's the curriculum that's up for grabs.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not focusing on that.
Yeah, I hear exactly what you're saying. And the question really at the end of the day is, what unites us?
Correct.
And how does a nation go forward if there's nothing that unites us? And there has to be an agreement around that. Well, Gary Nell, the president and CEO of the National Geographic Society, I want to thank you for being here this evening and for such an interesting conversation. Now, tell us about your website. And with so much content on it, what is your personal recommendation of something up there that listeners should definitely check out?
Okay, so just to make things really complicated, we have a nationalgeographic.com website, which has a lot of our amazing daily content and videos from Saturn to the future of – or to the new Jane Goodall documentary coming up. And we have nationalgeographic.org, which has the coolest thing, the Explorer map.
Okay.
So everyone listening has to go check this out. It's open source. You can look at it on iPad or a PC or whatever you have, and you'll be able to see the hundreds and hundreds of explorers around the world at any given moment and what they're working on. It's a fascinating tool to look to experience, and maybe you can be one of those too.
So very good. Gary, it was such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks so much, Denver.
I'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
Most teachers spend more than $500 of their own money on school supplies each year. That's because too many classrooms lack books, microscopes, art supplies, and even pencils. At DonorsChoose.org, you can help students and teachers get the resources they need for a successful education. Whether you support a field trip to a local museum, yoga mats for a health class, or technology to teach kids to code, you can join the 2 million individuals who've already made a difference in the classroom. Visit DonorsChoose.org to bring a classroom dream to life. Babies sure don't come with manuals. And for their moms living in poverty, it can feel impossible to make ends meet. Thankfully, there's Nurse Family Partnership to help new moms be the best they can be. Their nurses are always there for moms throughout pregnancy and after the baby comes home. A mom can change her baby's world. Nurse Family Partnership can help guide her there. Join in changing the future for babies born into poverty. Visit supportnfp.org.
Oh, hi, everybody. Do you know where Sesame Street is?
Sesame Street is right here.
Hello there.
Hola.
And here.
Hello.
And everywhere else. We can make a difference. Sesame Workshop is a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping kids here.
I got you know.
And around the world.
That's better than most. That is better than most. Better than most!
Better Than Most is a regular feature of The Business of Giving, examining the best places to work among social businesses and nonprofit organizations.
And this evening, you will be heading up just north of Columbus Circle in New York into the happy and oh-so-joyful offices of Sesame Workshop. We will begin the segment with their CEO, Jeff Dunn, and then hear from other members of the Sesame Workshop team.
I think it's the CEO's number one job. I've often said to people, if you know well the CEO of a company, know who that person is, you can predict the corporate culture. Conversely, if you don't know the CEO at all, but you know the corporate culture, you can predict pretty clearly what the attributes and values of the CEO are. Because over time, the CEO and the culture get very closely aligned. Whatever attributes and values the CEO has and expresses and brings and says, this is what's important to me, that's what the company begins to absorb and take on and deliver on. So the CEO owns the positive and the CEO owns the not so positive. So I think a lot about it. I think about what do we do to have the right culture here? How do we make sure that we articulate what we want our culture to be? And then what are the things that we can do to try and deliver on having that culture?
I think one of the biggest surprises that a new employee will experience about the workshop culture is that we don't consider our Muppets to be children's characters. We actually consider them to be colleagues. Elmo is as real to me as Lewis is sitting across this table. And I think it's because when you work at Sesame Workshop, you can be walking by a conference room and the performer for Elmo will be in there perhaps reading a script or reading a storyline. And it's just, you're just walking to the water fountain and you hear Elmo out of the corner of your, coming from across the hall and you think, oh, yep, that's Elmo.
Oh, so Elmo could be a kindness kid? Boy, Elmo can't wait to do something kind for somebody.
I was given the opportunity outside of my regular responsibilities to head a communications group, which was a cross-functional group of people, different levels and different departments represented. And the sole goal of the group was to help foster communications, both sort of vertically up to senior management as well as across departments. And for me personally, it was a great opportunity to take on a role outside of my regular responsibilities and get to work with different people. But most importantly, we as a group really had the ear of senior management. And I was very impressed by the fact that they really wanted to hear what people had to say. They wanted feedback about what's working well for the organization, what's not. They took it very seriously. I was often the representative kind of sharing the feedback from the group to management, which wasn't always an easy role to be in, but they would hear it and they would think about how they wanted to act on it, and they've taken tremendous steps to really act on that. And so I think that has helped foster a real sense of openness and transparency for the organization.
Because it's exactly the same process. We get our work done the same way in every single territory, in every single co-production. We sit down as a team and we discuss, what are those features that we want in this new Muppet? Or what are the goals that we want to achieve in creation of a new format? And it was really incredible. The team around the table was so enthused by this because they were like, you've been doing it for 40 years, and yet you still ask the same question as you're asking us, where we're creating this for the first time in Afghanistan with our Muppets.
One of the things that I find so unique to Sesame Street is you could have the world's worst commute. Here in New York City, you can expect the subway to treat you horribly on a daily basis. And you could come in and you could have had like such a tough day already at 9:30 in the morning. And you walk in and you see a mural of Sesame Street in black and white with all the Muppets in color smiling and having a great time. And you look at that and you're like, how could anything in my life ever be bad? It is just such a welcoming environment to step into the office every single day. And then when you go to your desk, everybody's desks are covered in Sesame paraphernalia.
So some of the things that I brought here was what we call Ask Jeff Anything, which is people get to submit anonymous questions before every staff meeting. And the reason I make it anonymous is because people won't ask you the things that they really want to know, particularly if it's unpopular, if they have to stand up and put a face and a name to it. But if you allow people to submit them anonymously, then you really get to know what's on people's mind.
Yeah.
And if you answer them, and you answer them honestly, and you make all that available to people on a regular basis, then they get to know what's going on. The death of any culture is the grapevine. And what you want to do is you want to prevent the grapevine from going off in a lot of different directions, because information abhors a vacuum, right?
Mm-hmm.
So by allowing employees to ask whatever questions they want of me, and promising them an answer and giving them an answer, and we post all the answers. We make it all public. It's all public on our – well, within public, I say within our company.
Yeah, sure.
People get to know what's really going on here.
And I was instrumental in naming the conference rooms after characters and naming the printers after characters. So we try and keep it fun here at the office. But definitely Sesame, I've worked in a few other places, but Sesame has the perks pretty much nailed down. And not many of them have changed. I mean, they've gotten better. I don't feel that any of the perks have been taken away, but we've got amazing benefits here, from the 401k to the having off the between Christmas and New Year's, and the amount of PTO days you get, and just the understanding when there's family emergencies or bereavement, to the maternity leave. I've had the opportunity of being out on two very generous maternity leaves while here at Sesame. And all of my friends and family are just like, how does your company allow you to be out for so long? But I think it speaks to the mission and how important family and children are to Sesame Workshop.
One of the questions that came to mind for me was, how are decisions made? And I'll say that for me, that has been one of the biggest surprises and delighters for me joining the workshop, pretty recently. And if I had to boil it down to one word on how decisions are made, I would say collaboratively or inclusively would be the words I would choose. And there have been huge initiatives that have been put out company-wide based on upward feedback, and Jeff, our CEO, implemented some of these initiatives.
Here I am just a few years into my career, and I've booked a meeting with the United States Ambassador to Bangladesh. And I think it's important for any employee to feel like your employer trusts you to go out and do the business for the organization and the brand. And I have seen that with a lot of my colleagues, and I think a lot of people at Sesame Workshop appreciate that type of trust and respect.
I was asked to be part of the Principal for the Day program. And again, I didn't even realize that we participated in that, but one of the chief executives actually asked me if I would do it. I said, well, sure, I'll do it. He said, you can pick whatever school you want. So I went to my elementary school, and I actually brought with me Elmo and Ernie. And I'm not allowed to do the voices or anything like that, but I snuck a little bit and did a little bit of Ernie, only because this little boy, I met a lot of children on the spectrum of autism, and this little boy was brought from another school by his mother. He loved Ernie, but she didn't know he was going to be there, so she went and got him, brought him to the school, and I said, I have to do a little bit for him, because, you know, this is his favorite cat, so I did, you know, Ropadookie and things like that. The kid was looked frozen. He didn't respond, but you know, he was a nonverbal child on the spectrum. Later on, I got a letter from that woman. I'm trying to find the letter. She told me that for the first time her child started to speak, he didn't put sentences together, but he started to talk about Ernie. Ernie, talk to me, Ernie. And he just kept on, and she didn't know what to do with herself because it was a miraculous moment. So talk about wow factors. These characters have impact on so many people, from children to adults. And I know this can be a long story, but it gives me chills every time I say that. It's one of the most amazing moments of my life in general, but it happened through Sesame Workshop.
I want to thank Elizabeth Fishman for helping to organize my visit, and to all those who participated in this piece, Jeff Dunn, Bridget Miles, Janelle Petrovich, Lewis Henry Mitchell, Esti Bardanashvili, Sharak Slater, Philip Toscano, and Diana Pulver. If you go to denverfrederick.wordpress.com, you can hear this again, read the transcript, and see pictures of the participants and the offices of Sesame Workshop.
With nearly 1 in 4 New Yorkers struggling to meet their most basic needs, we know our city is facing a crisis. But did you know that our highest poverty rates are among women and mothers? These women don't need handouts. They need a hand up. That's why Grameen America provides tens of thousands of women across our city with the loan capital they need to start their own small businesses. With the gift of entrepreneurship, these women have the opportunity to escape poverty, provide for their children, and gain independence. Join the movement today. Invest in New York City by investing in them. Visit GrameenAmerica.org to learn more. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from the Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
If you work in the development department of a nonprofit organization, you will hear the term donor acquisition more times than you can count. But you won't hear the phrase donor retention nearly so much. And my next guest thinks that's a problem. She is Allison Fine, and her most recent book is Matterness: Fearless Leadership for a Social World. Good evening, Allison.
Good evening, Denver. How are you?
Doing fine. So my organization, for example, has acquired a new donor. How likely are they to make a second gift?
Here are the numbers. After that first gift, they are only 40% likely to give the following year. That number is pretty well known in the field. What's not talked about often enough is that after 5 years, only 10% of those original donors are left.
Wow. Well, if that's the case, and if the drop-off is that precipitous, online revenue is continuing to grow. How is that happening?
It's just transactional. It's so easy to send online messages, and it's so inexpensive. Most organizations are just going to email us to death until somebody finally throws their hands up in surrender and says, fine, I'll give you something to hopefully make you go away.
So it's volume, volume, volume. What do you suggest an organization do to change that relationship with the donor?
So we have to change the culture of giving. It's so transactional now because it's so front-loaded. The only numbers that most organizations are looking at are acquisition numbers. How many people did we get to come right into the front door? And then they don't look beyond that. So we have to move to a culture of relationship building that starts with, why are people giving to us? What do they like about us? How does it feel to give to us? And then growing that relationship from there. It's too easy for organizations to slide into that frantic over-emailing, as we just said. It takes some more work to realize that people aren't ATM machines, that they have interests and passions and feelings, and to steer organizations towards understanding that these people have much more to give than just their dollars, and that they will give to organizations that make them feel good.
Are you suggesting here, Allison, that these organizations have conversations with their donors?
As much as it scares people to death, yes, I am. We are actually capable of having two-way conversations. You know, Denver, that is the beauty of social media. The difference between social media and broadcast media is that social media requires conversations. They are two-way interactions. Somebody says something, the expectation is that other person or entity can and should say something back, unlike broadcast, where you're just throwing messages at people and hoping something sticks.
Mm-hmm.
So here we have all of these different platforms, Instagram, Snapchat, Facebook, Twitter, blogs, that are architected for conversation, and yet that is exactly the thing that seems to scare organizations to death, really, is that they will be caught in a time-consuming conversation with people.
Give us an example of people or organizations who are doing this well.
Oh, sure. The Los Angeles County Museum has really fun and chatty posts on Snapchat about their exhibits, and they ask people to weigh in with different comments about them and their own photos of coming to visit the museum. So it becomes an experience between the organization and their supporters.
Give us another example, Allison.
Well, Planned Parenthood has been doing this well for a long time. Do you remember back a few years ago, Denver, the brouhaha between Planned Parenthood and Komen?
Oh, quite well.
Right? That really, it blew up, and it wasn't just online. It was also in broadcast and on land places, but the online component was fascinating because Planned Parenthood had been investing in relationship building and conversations for years online, particularly on Facebook. And when this blew up, they were ready to engage in their support with their supporters of what this meant and why it happened and what people could do to demonstrate their unhappiness with Komen. At the same time, you could watch as Komen was not in any conversations, totally in a broadcast mode, and actually shut down their Facebook page to avoid having conversations with people. And we know how that turned out.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? I think by the time Komen got together in the boardroom, the verdict had already been in. So
that's
it shows
just
this,
right.
Yeah, the speed of social media is absolutely unbelievable. Well, these are some great observations and insights, Allison. Thanks so much for sharing them with us this evening.
My pleasure, Denver. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
A simple smile can say so much. It can say thank you, please, or even I love you. Sometimes a smile can say more than words could ever express. But what if you couldn't smile? Unfortunately, that's the sad reality for so many children today. Without the help of life-saving surgery, helpless children find themselves cast aside and all alone. But it doesn't have to be this way. To learn how you can help Smile Train, the world's largest cleft charity, change the world one smile at a time, go to smiletrain.org. It's time for Take Five, a recurring feature of the Business of Giving with five or so quick questions posed to the leaders of the world of philanthropy, business, and social enterprise.
We are going to do Take Five with Eric Kessler of Arabella Advisors. Are you ready, Eric?
I'm ready.
What idea in philanthropy is ready for retirement?
Traditional philanthropy, giving to the same 10 organizations every year and not really thinking about outcomes.
What should we be worried about?
Everything.
What is today's most underreported story?
The impact of philanthropy, the role that it's playing in place of government support.
Is there something really weird or unsettling that happens to you on a regular basis?
I get thanks from folks for having grown a business.
What is something that you believe that other people think is just insane?
That we should all spend more time sailing.
What is the most important thing that makes for a healthy organizational culture?
Happiness.
What have you changed your mind about in the last 10 years and why?
What the biggest issues are facing our society.
When was the last time that you were voluntarily disconnected from all your devices?
3 weeks ago on safari in Zimbabwe for 7 days.
If you were a kitchen utensil, what would you be?
A strainer.
What do you wish more people would be open and honest about?
Their weaknesses.
What one superpower would you like to have?
The ability to desalinate ocean water.
If you could have one gigantic billboard anywhere with anything on it, what would it say?
Gratitude.
What is the one book you would give as a gift?
The Giving Tree.
If you were asked to speak at a TED conference on a topic completely away from your area of expertise, and that includes sailing, what would it be?
Raising kids as entrepreneurs.
Given the choice of anyone famous in the world, dead or alive, that you could have come over to your place for dinner, who would you invite?
Alexander Hamilton.
When was the last time you sang to yourself?
In the shower this morning.
To someone else?
In my grade school play.
What is the worst advice you see or hear being dispensed to young people today?
Go to an Ivy League school.
What advice would you give to your 25-year-old self?
Don't have the 26-year-old birthday party that you're planning at the moment.
Well, thanks, Eric. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
And that is this week's show. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And do return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.